Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Hi, welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name's Mike Calvin. I'm joined by David Preece, goalkeeper, coach and columnist, and Seb Stafford-Bloor, editor of Tifo Football. Now, we could probably agree Eden Hazard is one of the best footballers on the planet, but I wish he'd make his mind up. He says he loves playing for Chelsea under Sarri. He appears to cover a move to Real Madrid. Now he fancies playing for Jose Mourinho. Is he just bored in International Week, or is he at a crossroads in his career? What do you think, Dave?
Well, he's at an age now where the next move's really important. You know, there's no second chances after this one, really. He's in a great position. I think when a club like Real Madrid comes in with it, you don't see many fans stand, or managers for that matter, standing in your way. It's a dream move for him. But the problem is that I think he's probably third on their list of most wanted players, and he knows that as well. So I think he's just trying to keep everyone happy.
Who are the other two then?
Oh, I'd say Neymar and Christian Eriksen. Just from what I was reading in some of the Danish newspapers yesterday, saying that they think that that Eriksen's above Hazard. Of course, he's younger. They'll get more out of him, and perhaps he's more the player that they want. And if they get Neymar, you wouldn't have thought that Hazard would be needed anymore.
Mm, yeah, I suppose irrespective of all that, it's a nice scene setter for Jose Mourinho at the bridge on Saturday lunchtime. Is he in a minority of one in wanting to play for Jose Mourinho?
I think he's actually been quite smart. I think, Mourinho has probably damaged his reputation a little bit across the continent, but the one chairman, president, whatever, owner, who will always love Mourinho is Florentino Perez. Even despite what happened last time he was at Madrid, he would still happily appoint him if Lopetegui has to be moved on mid-season, I think, and if Mourinho was to become free. I don't know, it's a strange one because Hazard never seemed happy under Mourinho. He also seemed, I think, sort of for much of the time that he spent in England, Hazard seemed to have had to operate almost in a box, in that kind of shallow left position where, you know, he's playing, you know, 1-2s with players on the edge of the box and trying to move from there. Whereas the player we've seen in the last few weeks, certainly the first few weeks of this season, seems freer, more expansive, broader. We're finally getting to see just what a good player he actually is. And for the first time in his career, there's a legitimate conversation for him being the best player in Europe at the moment. And that's not a coincidence, and that certainly didn't happen under Mourinho. So I think it's political. I think he's being well advised, or maybe he's just being smart. I'm not sure.
I think so. Because if Real Madrid don't come calling for him, then, you know, and he wants even more money or a different kind of move than, you know, Manchester United's obviously one place where he could go. But just going back to what he's talking in midweek about Mourinho and how he's apologised to him because he thought that he was one of the main reasons why he got the sack. And I think sometimes we think the players are, I don't know, more cynical or even a little cleverer than what they really are, because once you go out on that pitch, once Hazard goes in front of 35, 40,000 at Stamford Bridge, then he's not going to try and lose the game or not try and win games. He wants to impress. And to think that some players can switch it on and off or try to switch it on and off, it's
professional pride, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, and there is a, no matter what you think about a manager, when a manager gets fired, whether you're playing or not, if you've played a part in that and you haven't played well, there is a guilt. You know, there is a, a feeling that's that you kind of, I don't know, that maybe that you owe them something, but, you know, that you let them down. It's, he clearly feels that as well.
Mm. But players quickly move on to trying to impress the next guy, don't they? It was interesting you mentioned, you floated that possibility of Mourinho maybe going back to Real Madrid. Do you think that's realistic?
I don't know, Mike. I don't know where else he would go. I think if you look at the mentality of the modern super club and what's important to them, the football, of course, but also the image and the branding and the kind of and the style of football they play. I mean, can you imagine, for instance, Paris Saint-Germain appointing Mourinho? I mean, they are, you know, they in their own minds they stand for something which is not really, you know, his associations don't really tally with.
Was that style without substance?
Your words, your afternoon on Twitter after that. But I don't know. I just think it's a kind of, it's the most likely place. Also, if you look at what's happening there at the moment, Madrid, you know, I understand why a player like Hazard would covet that move, but do you really want to play for Madrid right now, where you've got sort of five or six players, all of who were fundamental to their European Cups, are coming towards the end. They're not at the end, but they're approaching that point in their careers. And, you know, there's no such thing as... at any given point, there aren't enough world-class players playing for any club just to default between cycles. You know, you don't go from the top of a cycle to another one just by virtue of a few swift checks, because the players don't exist. So Madrid are going to have a little bit of a... transition's a bit of an overused word, but, yeah, that. So a strange one.
So maybe they see Mourinho as an upper-class Sam Allardyce.
That's practically libelous. Maybe, but, I mean, he's also, you know, the pragmatism aspect of his management style, that applies to that kind of situation. Do you want to win and nothing else? Yes, if you're Madrid. So, you know, that's a realistic option, I think.
There's been sort of personal rivalries over the last few years with Messi and Ronaldo, and that sort of, it's kept the focus on La Liga. And it's interesting yesterday that I can't remember his name, but the head of La Liga was saying that...
Tebas.
And he was saying that his wish would be for Guardiola and Mourinho to be back in La Liga. And then, of course, that's sort of spices that up again and gives La Liga another real rivalry.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see what the reaction to Mourinho is when he goes back to the bridge. Is he almost destined to be respected rather than truly loved?
I think just, of course, you've got to be respected. And I think he is. I mean, I'm not a Chelsea fan, but I mean, I would imagine that he's still loved there for everything that he's done for the club. Yeah, he's made the club what it is today. And you could say they wouldn't have been, even though he wasn't manager at the time, they wouldn't have been European champions without him being there beforehand. But just. Things chip away at his legacy there, you know, and I still keep going back to the Eva Canero incident, whereas I still can't get my head round that he didn't try and head that off in any sort of any form before it got to where it did. Whether he meant it or not, that was another thing, but the fact that he didn't...
He doubled down on it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well,
yeah,
David, when it happened.
And I'm not saying it would have bought him more time or would have changed what happened, changed history, but just think from on a human level and, he was stupid not to do that.
Yeah, we're led to believe there's peace in our time at Old Trafford. How fragile is that peace, Seb?
Very, very. I mean, I think it's really easy to sort of... not get carried away, but allow, you know, three quick goals against Newcastle to paper over a lot of cracks. I think there's a fundamental issue in the dynamic at Old Trafford, and winning, you know, against a poor Premier League team doesn't change that. I think, you know, soon we'll be in another transfer window and I fully expect all the same old problems to come back. And, you know, the dysfunction that exists between Ed Woodward and Jose Mourinho and the vast ideological chasm which seems to exist between them, that will create more problems. It's an untenable situation without, you know, unless a director of football comes in or a technical director or something, or there is some sort of renovation of the footballing structure there. I don't see how this has a happy ending.
Because we've got Paul Pogba in the international break being Paul Pogba. He's basically been a fashion icon this break, hasn't he? Let's look at maybe the midfield dynamics of that game against Chelsea. Is that where the game could be won or lost?
Well, I mean, if you look at those two areas, you'd think that at the moment Chelsea would win that battle. Mm. Because they seem to have a plan, they seem to have a structure and a way of playing, and the players have quickly bought into that. And whereas Mourinho, you talk about structures, you see them play, and there's no pattern of play. There's no sort of there's no. You look at it and think, well, what's he trying to do here? Is he just relying on the quality of the players that he's got, individual quality, and that's what it seems like to me.
Mm-hmm. With the other sort of flip side of this fixture is that it will shine a beacon on Sarri as well. Mm-hmm. Give me a progress report.
It's really interesting because obviously he came in the summer, he ditched the three centre-back system, he renovated, he brought David Luiz back in from the cold, partnering with Rudiger. That functions quite well. There are a few little issues. I mean, even going back to their last game against Southampton, Danny Ings should have scored from underneath the crossbar. Ryan Bertrand had another very good chance. So there are gaps there. The midfield is very interesting because he's moved Kante forward, brought Jorginho in, and he's getting a tune out of Ross Barkley, which I never thought was possible. I thought it was a conundrum that no one could fix, no one could solve. I think the great success there is, firstly, the way they move the ball, what he's been able to get out of Hazard as well. Like, because he hasn't really got a forward who suits his style of play. I mean, Giroud has merit as a centre forward. Obviously, Morata isn't quite mobile enough to replicate what was happening in Napoli. I mean, if you remember, he had Dries Mertens playing there. He's a very fluid player, he's an ad-libbing guy. So with those restrictions, he's done remarkably well. He's an unbeaten team. No one really spoke about them before the beginning of the season. And also, when a new manager comes in, especially when one of these sort of high priest ideologues comes in, there's always this assumption that you've got 2 or 3 months of sort of everyone resisting the ideas, no one really knowing what's going on, and then it clicks. As it did with Conte, actually, really. Mm. As it did with Guardiola. And yet, there's this... Chelsea have blended their kind of familiar sort of... You know how they... At their best, they're a very mechanical team. Mm. They're a robotic sort of winning entity. But they have some style with that. So he's kind of created this sort of best of both worlds situation. Where that stands up when they go away to the Etihad Stadium, I don't know. Or, when they play Tottenham away, or, when they go to... when they go to Anfield, it's a different matter. But so far, so good. Absolutely.
It's interesting. I don't think I'm being unkind here, because most fans probably wouldn't have known that much about him when he was appointed. But within the game, I sense he was well respected. I found it very interesting that Eddie Howe spent time with him at Empoli in 2015, studying his sessions. Does that tell us a lot when you get a young manager going to someone like that, wanting to learn?
Yeah, I think it's the reason why he's sort of so maybe refreshing, or the people look up with him as well, is because he's a bit of an outsider. Mm. He hasn't come from within the game. He hasn't been in football since he was 15, 16 years old. So it's something different. He hasn't been shaped by other people around him. He's been able to think for himself. And the way that he's come through, he's been able to... The way that he plays... he's been able to shape, like I said, without any sort of, with any blinkers on, any restraints. And I think that sometimes that's great and it's refreshing for people like Eddie Howe, who have been in football, and it makes you think totally differently. And I think it says a lot about Eddie Howe as well. Mm. The fact that that he's willing to learn from people who aren't met perhaps the first to come to mind.
Yeah. You look at Bournemouth, 16 points. Mm-hmm. They've done terrifically well, almost under the radar to a degree. They had their best away performance at Watford just before the break, which probably is significant since most of it's been founded on their home form. Do we give clubs like Bournemouth enough credit?
Probably not. I mean, I think one of the reasons we don't is because, and it's actually one of the reasons Bournemouth are successful, not a lot changes at Bournemouth. There are no headlines with that side. They're not. I mean, I know Eddie Howe has made a couple of signings over the summer, but they are not an improvement by transfer kind of team. Therefore, they don't attract a lot of attention. But I think if you compare where they are and what they are with the same last season, especially going into the winter, they look like a hopeless case. And I think where Howe really deserves credit is what he's able to do with incumbent players. So last season, for instance, they had all kinds of issues at home, away. They were such a soft touch. And over the winter, there was a kind of gradual hardening their system. And he's done that with players. You know, he's done that without taking the easy route of saying, right, well, I need a £50 million forward from there and a £20 million defender from there. I mean, it's this organic development. It's so impressive. Mm. And if you spend time with him, of course, he's a bright guy. He's an engaging person. He actually reacts to journalists' questions as well. There's a lot to like there.
Mm. And they've done really well in the. I know taking your point, yeah. But you know they've done really well in terms of bringing players in. You know, Ake last season,
Brooks this season,
Brooks who's always looked a player at Sheffield United. Mm. Jefferson Lerma's just come in and he's just giving him time to bed in. So there's a lot right strategically there, isn't there?
Yeah, exactly. And there's what you said about it seems to be the way forward. Teams in the past did what Fulham did all the time. They just think, we've got no Premier League experience. You know, there's wholesale changes. And when that happens, you know, it's like a flick of a coin whether they can all gel or not.
Yeah. And it's a bit sort of throw the mud at the wall and see what sticks.
Yeah, exactly. And so if you keep that core of players together, and he has done, he's kept a lot of players together since they got promoted. You know, that counts for a lot these days. And I think if you just keep tweaking it every year, like he has done with one or two big signings, I mean, with Brooks, of course, I don't think anybody thought that. Everyone knew he was going to be a great player, going to be a good player, but nobody thought he was going to sort of hit the ground running like he has done. And he's improved even further.
Yeah. When we're talking about Eddie Howe, should we be talking about him as a credible successor to someone like Mourinho at Old Trafford?
If that was purely a footballing conversation, yes. It's like, as we said earlier, Mike, I don't think that counts for as much as it used to. I think, you know, when one of those clubs appoints a successor to, you know, to a Mourinho or to a Wenger in the past, they want a commercial payoff as well as, you know, a footballing solution. If you want someone that's going to create stability within your side, is going to oversee gentle improvement over a long period of time, absolutely. I don't think that's really what the bigger clubs want. It's not right, but I don't see it. I'd like to, but I don't think it will happen.
We've got another instalment of the managerial bromance that is David Wagner and Jurgen Klopp on Saturday in the BT Sport game, Liverpool at Huddersfield. It almost feels a bit last season, that, doesn't it? Have things changed fundamentally at Huddersfield in terms of, you know, people are looking at that now? And OK, last season might have been a miracle. This one might be a step too far.
You see a lot with teams that work a certain way and they're obviously punching well above the weight. And if they're going to implement the ideas that manager wants, everyone has to be 100%. And if they're not 100%, then they don't look like a Premier League team anyway. I don't know whether they've gone a little bit more direct this season. The hard work of... And the enthusiasm of first getting into the Premier League, that's sort of ebbed away now, and it's everything's hard work, it seems, at the moment.
Yeah, they remind me of 90s Bradford. When they came up the first season, very similar, no one gave them any chance of surviving. Paul Jewell, they did, and then in the second season, because it's almost as if there's a, you know, there's an emotional debt to pay after you've, you know, if you, anything above 18th is always going to be a success, and when they achieve that, there's this sort of, I don't know, it all feels like a downturn.
Yeah. In that context, then, would Wagner be forgiven for starting to look around, you know, quite discreetly in the managerial market? You know, there are already murmurs from Fulham about Jokanović, simply because of what we spoke about earlier. Should he have one eye on the next move?
I think, like we talked about Hazard, he's in a great position. Mm. If they go down, I can't see them wanting to get rid of him. His association again with Klopp, that does him a lot of good. And so the more successful that young Klopp is, the more highly thought of he's going to be as well. If somebody comes in with him who he thinks have got a bigger budget, bigger club per se, I think it would be off.
Mm, I was very struck, Seb, by what Sarri was talking about, where he and Klopp were on the touchline at Stamford Bridge, and basically, you know, Klopp turned to him and said, "Look, I'm loving this, even though Liverpool were losing at the time."
Yeah.
You don't get that very often, do you?
No, no. It almost feels like a lot of these bigger games are sort of mini wars. It's always got to have not just a stale product on the pitch, but animosity in the technical area. And there's got to be a little subplot where both managers kind of hate each other in some way, and there's a handshake melodrama at the end. And yeah. The whole thing was refreshing. The whole afternoon was great. Just the aesthetic of this wonderful game played in the right spirit, and managers wanting their teams to play in the right way. It was great for the league. It was a great spectacle, that.
Mm. With Klopp, you know, he made it very plain before the break that he thought the Nations League was senseless. He's got even more reason now, hasn't he? When you look at Van Dijk coming back early and on, you know, a broader front, the muscle injury suffered by Mo Salah. Liverpool probably you can probably say, well, they'll get through a Huddersfield test. Mm. But before they get to Arsenal on November the 3rd, they need to have got all that sorted out, don't they?
Yeah. I think it's just a hangover from the World Cup, but it seems like we're all sort of international footballed out. Mm-hmm. I think, of course, the Nations League is more interesting than just pure friendlies. And lower down the scale, I think, sort of like in Group C and D, that's where the stories have really been.
Oh, the Gibraltar game.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And another side's being able to get their first wins in a long time. You know, that's where the stories have been, and that's where the value in this tournament is for those sides. But I think everyone's just a little bit tired. And without fail, I think everyone would rather have a run of Premier League games this weekend rather than international games.
Yeah, because I not for the first time, I found myself agreeing with Gareth Southgate, where he talked about, you know, the Premier League putting clubs in an impossible situation, yeah. You know, starting 2 weeks earlier than the Bundesliga, for instance. Do you think he's got a point?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's incontestable. I mean, if you think of some of the clubs who don't have the finances to rotate in almost a kind of a second 11 to get them through the opening month, you look at Tottenham. Mm. Tottenham looks spent. It's not even November and they look absolutely knackered because, you know, the core of their side is made up of players who got to the semi-final and played a third-place playoff, and, you know, 2 weeks off, back into pre-season, and straight into the Premier League. It feels like it's almost the Premier League wanting to get a march on the rest of Europe, yeah. And being the first league to open up. And I know Ligue 1 started the week before, but, you know, just long-term, there has to be a little bit more common sense applied.
They should have it's an English league, they should have just sort of catered for England getting to the final. Yeah. No matter what, no matter how fanciful that might be at the time.
They'd have been laughed at for
that. But
there was the sense that they did, that was part of the equation, wasn't it?
Yeah, and then so then you put it back 2 weeks, like we said, to the start of the season, put it back 2 weeks, and then put that on the end of the season, because I think it would be more value if, rather than the players finishing was the 13th, 14th of May, mm-hmm. then having a week off or 10 days off, and then going back to meet up internationals, they'd be far, far better finishing sort of later in May and then going straight to England. And then having the rest after that.
Yeah. Do you think we're reaching some sort of point of no return on that sort of relationship between clubs and countries? You know, Tottenham mm-hmm. were really annoyed with Roberto Martinez, you know, when he was, you know, revealing the extent of, Vertonghen's injury. You know, I know people don't like it. Are they now coming to hate it?
Possibly. I mean, the Vertonghen thing, I mean, Tottenham have always been vague with their player injuries and their reports and, you know, players.
And their stadium plans, by the way.
Yeah, true. I think hate's too strong a word. I think in this country there is a little bit of goodwill. I mean, I can only speak for myself. I look forward to England games a little bit more now. I know the
next. I was thinking more of clubs, though.
Well, I think that's already always existed, Mike. I think there's always been a resentment between, you know, the clubs who employ the players and pay the players. You know, you go back as far as Newcastle's issue with Michael Owen. I mean, it's set up to be antagonistic, that relationship. And it, you know, any time you take a player away from his club, and, you know, especially if he's a South American player, for instance, and he's got jet lag factored in and long flights and stuff, then, you know, it's very difficult to make that harmonious.
Mm. Do you think if you look at Spurs, they've got a combustible game at West Ham. Doesn't look like You know, Christian Eriksen's going to be around any time soon. You know, you've got good contacts in Denmark. What are they saying about it? Because there seems to be this hint that it could be quite a long-term injury.
Yeah, they did say it was a sort of chronic stomach problem. That's when they mentioned sort of the word chronic, then it's, you know, it's going to just take rest more than anything else.
Operations.
Hospital wars, don't you? Exactly. And when you start messing around with sort of the stomach, it's a very delicate area, and you can't rush people back. And there's a hell of a lot going on now, not just in football, but in the sort of wider world about sort of the mesh that they put into abdominal injuries and you know. It's exactly the same as what they put into footballers. And once you start delving into sort of the abdominal region, you always have problems with it. It's notorious. So it'll be something that they probably want more rest. And that's bad news for Spurs, because they won't, and he won't want to start going under the surgeon's knife.
Yeah, because the rest is needed. I was reading something on Football 365 this morning where they talked about Eriksen having played 255 games in 50 months. So, in other words, around about five a month. That is some workload.
Also, if you look at the stats underneath that and the distance he's covered, generally you find Christian Eriksen probably covers a kilometre, 2 kilometres more than any other Tottenham player on the field every single week. It's not a surprise. It's completely Tottenham's fault. They've invited a situation where they've run this small group of players who they're dependent on into the ground. They thought they'd been terribly smart over the summer, not adding anyone to supplement their group, and this is the result. Muscle injuries absolutely everywhere. Mm. So it's hard to have sympathy.
Yeah. I suppose one thing the break does is almost sometimes intensify that climate of hype and impatience. You know, if you look at Jadon Sancho, made an admittedly, you know, terrific impression in 10, 15 minutes, whatever it was at the end of the Croatia game. Suddenly, we're all talking about a £100 million transfer chase between four or five clubs, the usual suspects.
Yeah, well, door.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, it's what you'd be paying for then, if you're going to pay sort of £100 million for Jadon Sancho, what you're paying for is £100 million for an impact sub, because he's only proven at being that at the moment. And I know that sort of... even the Dortmund, there might be a clamour for him to...
He started the last couple of games.
Yeah, though, to start... begin to start games, but sometimes I think we're too quick to do that. And if somebody's having that much of an effect from the bench, as long as things are going okay on the pitch with the starting 11, you know, there's no need to rush it. Just keep that going and just give them one game here and there. Mm. But I think that it's just the acceleration of the hype's accelerated. Mm. By everyone wanting them just to be the next best, the next big thing, and to be the answer to all our problems.
Mm, he seems to be being well managed, and you know, is the best solution just to, you know, let the kid get on and develop.
Yeah, continuity is a great incubator for that kind of talent, and he's found a situation. I mean, the advantage of Dortmund is he's away from England, so every time he steps on a pitch for England and gives the kind of 10-15 minutes that he had. Last week, you're going to see this expectation ratcheted up. As soon as he goes back to his club, okay, highlights of his assists and his goals are going to appear on English Twitter. But generally, he's allowed to sort of grow in the dark a little bit, and I think that's very good for him. And also, you know, in Germany, maybe he's very well regarded, but nobody really cares in the same way that we would hear about the prospects of an English player long term, because he is another country's player. So just leave him be. I mean, he's in a great place. Lucien Favre is a very well-regarded manager. You know, there is no rush to change his circumstances for a couple of years at least.
Yeah. Mm. And the player we're talking about that we need, somebody who's creative and it can give us that spark. He's that. You know, speaking to coaches that had him in sort of youth size and academy size at Manchester City, the word they use is maverick. Mm. Not in a negative way. Said he was. He's excellent attitude, always working hard, but he did play with a real freedom that sort of gets ground out to you. The more the levels you go up, you know, more restraints put on you, and he hasn't allowed that. And the fact that he turned down a very good contract at Manchester City to go abroad just shows that, well, he's thinking about more than just just money.
And the people around him are doing that as well, which I think is key, isn't it? You know, and I always look at him as, and I see there's little flashes of a Sahar in there, where, you know, he has developed in urban football, really, in cage football, where, you know, that maverick nature is is indulged and encouraged. Do you think that's significant?
I think, yeah, I mean, I mean, David's probably better placed to answer this than I am, but I've always thought that players who grow up in a kind of sanitised environment seem to be overcoached. They seem to have this kind of, English players for a long time seem to be right, well, you can have 2-3 touches, but then you've got to move the ball. Yeah. It doesn't really matter what you do with it as long as you move it somewhere. I mean, I don't know.
I mean, it's not just the coaches that coach out of you. Sometimes, you know, as a player, you don't want people taking too many risks. Certainly, when I was younger, you think that I don't want somebody taking somebody in midfield because of what might happen negatively.
You've got to take
the fear out of it. And as I got older, you learn to appreciate that you don't always have to have your centre forward working really hard because he needs to conserve his energy for when he's got the ball. Mm-hmm. And you've got to change the way that we think. And I think looking at games now, when I go to watch sort of academy games, you see that a lot more. That it's great to see the freedom and confidence that the players play with without sort of feelings if like they have got restraints on them.
Mm. But the overriding factor is that football is a massive business, and you know, very cold decisions are taken within that business. Now let's look at Arsenal and Aaron Ramsey as an example of that. He's going to run his contract down, get an absolute shed load of money when he moves on in the summer. Is that understandable?
I mean, in a dispassionate way, yes, because it's probably a legacy of Mesut Ozil's contract. I mean, that was a vast sum of money that Arsenal have committed to him, and this is probably the knock-on of that. But no, I don't understand it because I think Ramsey's one of those players you have to replace. And how much is that going to cost when you do? Because he's not currently a starter on that side, but he's still a very good player, and he's still someone, if he wasn't in your squad, you have to replace with something somewhere. And that's, what, 20, 30, 40 million pounds probably, even in a younger player with that kind of promise.
Mm. I don't know. When we've got concentration on finances, do we sometimes don't know the full story? So if you look at Ramsey again, you know, the word coming out is for him to have a 5-year contract with all the add-ons, the agent's fees, etc., that'll cost £100 million for one player.
Mm. Yeah, and I think, you know, if you're looking at £100 million outlay, then you're probably thinking, well, can we go in a different direction? Okay, he scored goals in cup finals, he's a very good player, but they want to get back to another level again, to the level above, and might they just think that we're going to invest that more wisely somewhere else and in a younger player and somebody who's more effective?
If they can attract that caliber of player. I mean, they're not currently a Champions League side. They've got the wealth to attract that player. But, you know, if you want to move to that next level, if you want to sign a 24, 25-year-old player approaching his prime, Champions League is important. Mm. So it's a bit of a gamble from Arsenal's perspective, I think.
Mm-hmm. When you look at, you know, the way the world is changing, are Wolves a bit of a harbinger of what's going to come on in the future? You've got a very, very strong relationship, let's put it like that, with Mendes. Mm-hmm. Huge influx of money, you know, Chinese-driven. Their scouting network, I'm led to believe now, is nearly about 100 scouts.
Yeah. I think so. I think we'd be naive not to expect other people to replicate that model. What I will say is that I went to Wolves about 6 months ago to do a piece to talk to some local fans.
Feels like a proper football club, doesn't it?
That's exactly right. You go there. I mean, obviously things like that, they've got one of the best museums in the country in Molineux. So, you know, anyone who's never been should spend a couple of hours there. But Fossin, by all accounts, have done a very good job of making sure people know that they are there for the sake of the football club, not just for vanity, not just for the sake of maybe wanting to achieve something quickly with the first 11, they understand what they've bought. It probably is going to be the model. I think there's going to be variants of that model in terms of the kind of people that follow the example, and that's going to be a little bit more of a lottery, and it's certainly a bit more worrying because at what point are these football clubs just, you know, potentially holding pens for the ambitions of agents? And, you know, why is this money flowing into this country? What is it about these football clubs? What purpose are they serving these people beyond just the things that we care about? That's really the issue. So, yeah.
But is there, you know, a simple you know, football reason for them doing well. You know, 15 points, you know, a home to Watford at the weekend. Unchanged in eight games. They've conceded one goal in seven, unbeaten in six. Those numbers don't lie, do they?
No, but it's okay to say that they're well backed. Forsyth have got the funds to take things to another level again. Mm. They can, you know, I think that they can. They have the funds if they want to challenge for the Premier League title. I mean,
this season?
And maybe it's not this season, but certainly in the near future. But it's okay seeing somebody's got money. We've seen so many times, and yeah, the clubs have just frittered money away and on vanity signings, and it's not like they've bought some names. Moutinho's a name. Patricio's a name. Neves, you know, he's
become a name.
Yeah, he's become a name, but he was sort of one of the potentials. Mm-hmm. But the rest of them around them, you know, it's not. They're not household names that they've brought through.
They're good players. Like Bolly, the centre-back, is a brilliant player. Really.
You mentioned Neves there.
Yeah.
Is that going to be the acid test? Because Neves will attract the sort of 50, 60, 70 million bid from a Man City or United, whoever. Will we then gauge how serious Wolves are if they turn that down?
I don't know. I mean, I think in that isolated case, there's a sort of sense of inevitability. I think that depends on the player's ambition. I think what will sort of set Wolves' long-term course, if they, which they almost certainly will do, survive this season, they've proven to the continent, right, we're a stable organisation, we make sensible football decisions, and then the ambition will start to creep up a little bit. I think that's what will set the tone. Neves, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what kind of agreements were in place when he joined the club, you know, with, you know, given who his agent is and how fond his agent is of shuffling his pieces around the chessboard. Mm. I don't think that's a Wolves situation. I think that's, But I think they're very much for real. They are a scary proposition for the top six, certainly.
Okay. I'd like to give a good run at some of the questions from the listeners and the viewers. We'll start off with one on a club that you're quite familiar with, Newcastle, with all the attendant psychodrama that usually goes on there. The question is from Gerd de Keyser. Is Benitez really overachieving with Newcastle United? I think he's doing a very bad job. He's often parked the bus and still lost most matches. Isn't he past it?
Well, he's certainly not past it. I wouldn't say that at all. I think because a lot of the games that they're going into, because of everything that's going on in the background, OK, the fans are giving him a bit of a longer leash. He's very popular up there, as he was at Liverpool. He becomes more popular because the owner becomes more unpopular, I think, as well. But I think that from a neutral's point of view, which I probably think he is, was asking the question there, you have to think that you'd want them to go into games with a little bit more ambition.
Yeah.
Because, OK, they can say, well, one of my old managers had a great saying where the surgeon comes out of the operating theatre and says, oh, well, the operation went well, but the patient died anyway. So it's kind of what's happening with Newcastle. They're going to games where they're deploying this sort of defensive system and they're not getting, you know, not getting run all over the place, but they're not coming out with many points either. So it's, and it's okay for Benitez to say, well, we were in this position last season. Well, then there's probably a reason, you know, something was going wrong then as well. Mm. So surely there's got to be some change there.
Do you think, Dr. Stafford Bloor, the situation is terminal there? What's your prognosis?
You know, I spent the weekend reading Kevin Keegan's autobiography, and the whole thing was great, but the chapters about Newcastle are staggering the second time about... and remember, this is quite some time ago now, and this is sort of entry-level dysfunction. Yes, it's terminal as long as the ownership remains in place, just because the priorities aren't right. The focus isn't on football. I've always thought that I agree with David in the sense that that yes, it could be a bit more attractive on the pitch, but you're not just battling as a Newcastle manager. You're not just battling your squad limitations. You're battling a culture. That might be one of those sort of whiffy things that people like me overemphasise, but you have to believe it's a problem. I don't see how Newcastle progress. Because what is it about that club that makes a better standard of player want to join? Beyond the 50,000 fans and you know what football means in Newcastle. I respect all of those things, but they're not more important, unfortunately, at the moment than the person who owns it and the people who he employs beneath him.
It's not taking anything away from Wolves. Wolves is a big club.
Yeah.
They've got a huge history behind them. But can you imagine for one second that if Fosson had bought Newcastle, what would be going on there?
Yeah.
I mean, that whole city would just be, you know,
it'd be ablaze, wouldn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, unbelievable, yeah. And obviously that's what they're praying for, really.
Okay. Andy Sullivan asks, how do you think Thierry Henry will get on at Monaco?
Nobody knows, do they? Nobody knows. I mean, it's his first job. Okay, that he's been coaching under Martinez with Belgium, but we don't know what system he'll play. You know, what's his style gonna be? You'd imagine it'd be attacking, but
it's taken Kwame Ampadu, the Arsenal under 18 coach, with him, isn't he?
Yeah. So I mean, it probably, you know, you need somebody who does the nuts and bolts of, you know, putting the cones out and setting up the sessions, and that's the, you know, that's the. It's realism, but it's certainly interesting to see which way he's going to go. But
fit than Aston Villa, yeah.
Yeah, and it makes things a little bit easier, you know, that he's going to have a better squad. He's got a sort of better backing as well. It puts a lot of things in his favour anyway.
Okay. With your Tottenham hat on, probably here, Seb. Mark Lynch.
I try not to burst into tears. Like
Why do the media often peddle a negative narrative around Kane, but not to anyone else? Well, I'll disagree with that one. But he's had one season wonder, tap-in or penalty merchant, not scored in August, not done it in the big games, not done it in Europe, not done it for England, and now he's in a goal drought.
Well, I don't think there's a media agenda against Kane. I think opposition fans are tribal. I don't think that's about Kane, though. I think that's just the way the game is. I think we have this culture now where, you know, part of being an opposition fan is to tell rival fan bases why they shouldn't be enjoying themselves. It's a terrible illness in contemporary football. But so no, I don't think there is. I don't think I've ever met a journalist who doesn't like Harry Kane as a person and doesn't respect what he's achieved. I mean, maybe, you know, there are some sort of people on local beats who bang the drum for, you know, for their local players, but I don't really see that.
No, he's very good with the media, isn't he?
Oh, he is. I mean, he seems a very nice bloke. Yeah. But I mean, if there's anybody to blame the situation for whenever that Harry Kane doesn't score, it's Harry Kane himself, because he's set his standards sky high. You know, so if he's not scoring 30 goals every season, then, you know, questions will be asked. Why not? Because that's his normal.
Yeah, well, Kane is the first person to remove the excuses for himself. Like, he is, you know, even this weekend, he said, no, I'm not tired. It's not, you know, he's been offered that out many times this season already. You know, when he, in the first sort of few games through August, people, every question Pochettino got or Kane got was about his fatigue and about his sort of the amounts of football he's played. And he's just, no, it's not nothing to do with it. So, yeah.
Paul Fry asks, are we genuinely seeing the beginning of a conveyor belt of young English talent? And does this mean that the Qatar 2022 trophy target that was so widely disparaged is actually attainable?
I don't know whether that's...
Hospital pass.
I don't know whether that comes a little bit too soon, but it's certainly, you know, like I said, watching a lot more academy football than I used to. It's difficult not to compare those games against the own games you used to play.
You were saying you watched England under 17s.
Yeah, and I thought they were brilliant. And in the space of a year, when they played USA last year, physically they're quicker, stronger, they look a lot physically bigger. But the way they played was just brilliant. And I think, like I said, comparing against sort of my time, sort of England under 18s or 19s, these players look, you know, far more advanced than what we were in every way. And I think that's it looks promising. You know, I was one of the first people that criticised this whole DNA, England DNA, but because they've stuck with it, or they've stuck with one blueprint for long enough, now you're starting to see the benefits now. Yeah. I think I'm really excited, not even just at international level, but at club level as well, seeing the standard of play that's been produced.
Mm. And it seems that there's now, you know, that the ceiling that they hit is leading up into those under 23 games, which are still, you know, almost worthless.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a very broad conversation, that one. What its value is to the game, I don't know. I don't know what the answer to this is, Mike. I think if anything, I think Mason Mount's situation at Derby lately is very good for the game because it's shown you can still achieve things from the Football League. Mount's an outstanding player, so that obviously helps, and he's been, you know, he's been mapped for a very long time by the England technical staff. But, you know, it shows, right, well, there is no ceiling to dropping into the Championship long term, and there is no problem with, you know, actually going to play professional senior football. Don't just sit in an academy and play. I don't know what reforms you could offer to the under 23 setup, but I stopped watching those games quite a long time ago just because it's not, doesn't feel very representative of football. Doesn't feel like it's actually a preparation for anything, if that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Davey Joe, with the exception of the actual World Cup and Euro Championship finals, is international football becoming obsolete or an afterthought?
You know, we were talking before, we had a conversation away from football before we came, which is not a film, yeah, and I think that, I think the same about international football sometimes, because I think, you know, what's its purpose? Mm-hmm. You know, we have to get our head round, is it winning World Cups? Is it developing younger players? Because it is losing its significance, there's no denying that. And I think that, you're right, because we've had some success recently, that, you know, we get a little bit more interest in it. But
I think that feels temporary.
Yeah.
Like, it feels like a, you know, just a, it's refreshing not to be hopeless at a World Cup. So yeah. You kind of, but that has a lifespan, I think.
Yeah. Final question from Jordan Obb. How much confidence do you have in the FA to use the Wembley sale money, if it occurs, sensibly, and it not to be wasted on cronyism and bureaucracy?
Not a lot of confidence. There's a lot of hard question to answer. There's a lot of good people at the FA. They don't tend to be the ones you hear from, though. That's the difference. So if you meet sort of some of the internal staff, and you know, you get to see them do their work and what they're like, they're very impressive. The people at the top, they make baffling decisions. I mean, not just in relation to allocation of funding, but just, you know, terrible PR moments, like the Enya Luko thing and the Mark Sampson thing. It's just, and so you can't help but to factor that into, right, this, a huge sum of money like that should be invested in X, Y, and Z, and let's focus on grassroots, and, you know, kids have got to have playing fields to play on. Forget actual professional football, allow people to play the sport just for recreational purposes. And that makes sense to the three of us, but then a lot of other things which haven't happened at the FA make sense to us too. So, no, I'd love to be proved wrong, but I not a lot of confidence. Mm.
There's a lot of talk about investing, you know, if that's, you know, they get 600 million or whatever it would be from that sale, a lot would be reinvested in 3G pitches and things like that. I look around and I see 3G pitches not being used simply because they're taken over by leisure concerns and it costs 56 quid an hour to actually...
Yeah.
You've got to have a structure which supports that. You can't just invest in physical capital and then expect kind of the benefits of that to take root. There has to be some management of that goes along with it. So it's a convoluted process. I don't know whether the FA can manage that kind of thing. I don't know.
Okay. So the final question then. PSV, Ajax and Feyenoord have agreed to donate 10% of their earnings from either the Champions League or Europa League to the rest of the clubs in the Eredivisie to almost equalise or help equalise competition for the general good.
Yeah.
Could something like that ever happen in England?
I mean, I can't see it. I mean, whether that would make any difference, because the clubs in general here at the Premier League, they get a hell of a lot more than the Dutch clubs, and I think that's... If they did that, I don't think it would make much difference, would it really, to those clubs? I think the sums we're talking about, the fractions we're talking about, I think it would make more of a difference to those Dutch clubs than it would do over here. But and again, I can't see it happening.
Yeah, but should the general principle be, you know, rich helping the poor?
Yeah.
And, you know, you know, the Premier League will say, yes, we've got this solidarity money, but basically they use that as a baseball bat to hit people, yeah, to get into line. We need a almost like a step change in attitude, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's barely a week since Bruce Buck made his comments about, you know, not Chelsea shouldn't he made some terrible analogy about how, you know, Chelsea shouldn't be forced to return to the pack of the great unwashed or something. It's some awful, you know, callous comment which just exposed, you know how these clubs are so dismissive of the wealth disparity in the game. So yeah, he's got to be. It absolutely should exist because for the health of the sport itself, there is no Premier League originally without English football being what it is, and that is a, in my opinion, a debt which has to be repaid eventually. But the Premier League is a terribly powerful organisation. The clubs are even more so, and evidently there's no appetite for that at all, which is very dispiriting. But yeah, I think sort of the elite sides in this country have a crass dismissiveness of that issue, and it's upsetting.
Well, should something radical happen here? Definitely. Will it? Not in a million years. English football will eat itself. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud. Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.